Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. The first suicide bombing in Israel in nearly 2 months has killed at least 5 people and wounded at least 21 others in the northern town of Hedera today. The group Islamic Jihad almost immediately claimed responsibility, saying the bombing was in retaliation for the death of one of its leaders in an Israeli raid 2 days ago. Laura King is in Jerusalem covering the story for the Los Angeles Times. Laura, Israel had said earlier this year that it would abandon its policy of targeted killings. Islamic Jihad has said this bombing today was in response to the killing of its leader by Israel. So what are Israeli officials saying in response?
Well, Israeli officials are saying they doubt Islamic Jihad's claim that this was actually in response to the killing of an Islamic Jihad commander 2 days ago in the West Bank, because an attack of this magnitude normally takes several days or even weeks of lead time to prepare. They don't doubt that Islamic Jihad is in fact responsible, but they do doubt that it was actually staged in response to this killing 2 days earlier.
And we note from your writing that Israeli officials also said after the killing that they did not target the leader. They didn't intend to kill him. They were going after him because they suspected that he was planning attacks.
Well, that is what they said. That this operation was initially conceived as an arrest raid, but they certainly were not sorry that they had that he was one of the two people killed in the shootout, subsequent shootout with Israeli troops. He had been at the top of Israel's most wanted list for some time, and Israel has also said for some time that it considers people who are so-called ticking bombs to be exempt from this policy of no more assassination.
What has Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas said, if anything, about today's bombing?
Well, one of his top spokesmen, the Palestinian negotiations minister, Saeb Erekat, has said that has condemned the attack in the strongest terms. And only earlier today in the West Bank, President Mahmoud Abbas urged Palestinians not to give Israelis what he called an excuse to target Palestinians.
We're looking at scenes of the bombing on television. It looks, you know, chaotic, and I'm thinking that after a two-month reprieve, it must be shocking for Israelis. But you write, well, first of all, I'd love to hear what people are saying, what you're hearing. But you also write about a slow erosion of optimism in Israel, even before today's bombings.
Well, even before today's bombing, there has been just a steady drip of attacks involving one person dead or two people killed or three people killed. And although there has been an absence of large-scale attacks like this one, the violence has been pretty steadily ratcheting upward for about the past month.
Well, it seems as if we are right where we were last time we checked in on this topic. This week, the U.S. envoy in the area joined Palestinians in criticizing Israel for moving too slowly to open the borders to allow Palestinians movement from, and Israel is saying it's not safe to do that yet, and at least today they appear to have a point with a bombing within Israel that has killed at least 5. It seems as if it's the same stalemate.
That's true to some extent. The borders that were being discussed in this letter that you're referring to by James Wolfenson, the envoy for the quartet, was largely in reference to the borders of the Gaza Strip, which have been more or less sealed since Israel withdrew. So he was talking mainly about that, and probably the bomber in this case came from somewhere in the northern West Bank, which is adjacent to Hedera. But you're right that the whole dynamic is essentially the same, that Israel will say, we can't ease up on security measures because this is what we risk. And Palestinians will say daily life conditions will continue to deteriorate unless there is some kind of easing.
Laura,
so it is a stalemate in that respect.
Laura King, Jerusalem-based correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us after today's bombing that killed at least 5, Islamic Jihad claiming responsibility. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
2,000. That's the number that's reverberating in homes across America today. We're going to hear about the emotional toll of the latest tally of U.S. military killed in Iraq in a moment. But first, analysts are parsing this benchmark number, some of what they're finding. More than 90% of the deaths have come after President Bush announced an end to major combat operations on May 1, 2003. The troops killed have come from every state. Most have been young, male, ground troops. Roughly 70% have been active duty soldiers and Marines, about 30% from the National Guard and Reserves, who have sometimes died in clusters, devastating the American towns and cities they came from. Finally, the pace of U.S. deaths has accelerated over the past year, as have the insurgent attacks. Barry Posen teaches in the Security Studies Program at MIT here in the Boston area. Professor Posen, what do these numbers tell us about what's happening in Iraq? Fewer U.S. troops have died there than in other wars, certainly, but the toll does feel devastating.
The casualties that the United States has suffered in this war pale in comparison to the war the United States has fought against major industrial powers, or the war in Vietnam, which was not against an industrial power, but was against a very large and very well-supported insurgency. Nevertheless, the loss rate, which has escalated somewhat, is noteworthy for its relentlessness. Some have called the current situation a stalemate, but it's not a static stalemate, it's a dynamic stalemate. The bad guys, whoever they are, innovate and change. Our people innovate and change to respond to them. Then they respond to us.
Well, the number and rate of attacks has increased greatly. Does that mean that the number of insurgents has increased as well?
It's very difficult to tell whether the number of insurgents is going up or going down or staying the same. The United States and its Iraqi allies have certainly captured a good many people that they believe to be insurgents. I think there are 12,000 or more in custody. So that's subtracted from the adversary's capacity, and many thousands of the adversaries have been killed. Nevertheless, it's pretty clear that their organization is very resilient. So it was either much, much larger to start with than American officials thought, or it has an ability to recruit new members fairly efficiently. And I think both things are true.
Well, what are some of the other things that, in your mind, are marking this conflict?
Well, I think one of the I shouldn't say interesting, but new things for the United States is the conflict is going on for many months, and the U.S. is fighting it with an all-volunteer force. So we're ending up with a situation where, which has been commented upon in much of the press today, that you have American soldiers that have done, you know, easily two tours in Iraq and soon to be three for many. Mm-hmm. And you're going to keep sending these people back. And it's hard not to have an uneasy feeling that the institution is going to be put under tremendous stress.
In fact, we're reading that of the 2,000 killed, more than 420, the majority of them, Marines and soldiers, have died while on repeat tours.
Yes, it's very sad. It's a tribute to their commitment to the organization and to their patriotism. But none of us should be surprised, or we shouldn't be, in some sense, depressed if after two tours or three tours, the individual soldier or Marine says enough. And we also shouldn't be surprised if, given the stalemated pattern of the war, that the military has increasing difficulties recruiting, which it certainly is having.
A Gallup poll in late September found that 59% of Americans called this war a mistake. That's the highest number since the poll began asking that question. Right now, the White House refuses to talk about a timetable for withdrawal. But we read a new report published yesterday in the Institute for International and Strategic Studies in London that predicts that most of the U.S. troops now in Iraq will have to remain there until after President Bush leaves office in 2009. What is the current thinking about how long, you know, in the Pentagon, about how long troops will have to stay?
It's my impression is that there's a debate in the administration, on the political side of the administration, and to some extent that debate exists in the military about whether or not the smart thing for the United States to do is to develop an expeditious disengagement strategy, in other words, measured but expeditious disengagement strategy that reduces American forces significantly over the next couple of years versus some version of staying the course, whatever that means, right? And you see bits and pieces of this debate will occasionally creep into into the public domain, but it's hard to know how intense that debate is on the inside and whether or not it's, you know, one side or the other has definitively won. I think given, you know, what we've experienced with this particular president, he does not have an easy time disengaging from something that turns into a mistake, and particularly I think will not have an easy time disengaging himself from a policy that he considers to be central to the global war on terror, which is the defining moment of his administration.
Well, I know tomorrow you're going to be moderating a forum asking that question, not if the U.S. should pull out of Iraq, but when and how, and talking about some of these disengagement strategies. But how does that happen politically when there's so much divisiveness? Some Democrats who were firmly against the war are now for staying to keep the security. Some Republicans who were for the war now want the troops out. It seems to be all over the map.
It is all over the map. My sense is that the Republican Party is concerned about the off-year elections, and they're also concerned about the next presidential election. One problem that they have would be going into these elections with the appearance that the war is in some sense a futile stalemate, which is a perception that one could form from reading the press at this moment. You know, we also have to consider the intellectual side of that. What does the argument for disengagement look like? How would a political movement to disengage work? And it seems to me that there's three phases to the argument. I mean, one is that people would have to come to believe that the war is at a stalemate. And I think the polls show that many, many Americans believe that, but what would have to happen is many people in the government and the military would have to believe that. And then the second thing people would have to come to believe is that this stalemate is not likely to change. The Americans will do a little better some months, the Iraqi government will do a little better some months, the insurgents will do a little better some months, but the basic prediction for the future is this dynamic stalemate, right? And I'm not sure that many people believe that at this point. And then the third thing people would have to believe is that there is a plausible disengagement strategy that deals with many of the downside risks that particularly the Bush administration and supporters are prone to cite: the risks of regional war, the risks of civil war, the risks of jihadi success and conquest of Iraq. All these risks have to be discussed, and strategies to buffer against those risks have to be enunciated, and then people have to ask themselves whether they're persuaded. And we've barely done that in this country. There's been almost no serious discussion of what a reasonable disengagement strategy has looked like. Instead, the partisans of engagement have basically asserted that disengagement is highly risky relative to staying in Iraq, and that has been essentially a debate ender. And it's, you know, it's time to start thinking seriously about what a disengagement strategy would look like.
Barry Posen teaches in the Security Studies program at MIT. Professor Posen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And by the way, for more on tomorrow's MIT panel on exit strategy in Iraq, go to our website, here-now.org. And just ahead, a woman who pledged to make a quilt for the families of every U.S. soldier and Marine killed in Iraq. When the toll was 200, it was difficult. Now that it's at 2,000, on some days it seems impossible. Also later in the program, James Isaacs on a new treasure trove of old jazz masters. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. With the number of American servicemen and women killed in Iraq at the 2,000 mark, Jan Lang is struggling to keep up. Jan runs a group that makes quilts for families of those killed in Iraq. She joins us now from her home outside St. Louis in Missouri. And Jan, it's of course troubling for anyone to hear that the number of troops killed is now at or over 2,000. But you have this promise to keep. How are you keeping up?
Yes, it seems like every time we think that we are getting closer to getting more current with the quilts that we are making, the number that die each day outnumber the amount of quilts that we seem to get accomplished.
You backordered, I understand, several hundred?
We are currently, looks to be almost 700 behind at this point.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Why did you decide to take this project on?
it started back in 2003 when my son Alex, who was with 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines, Charlie Company, was part of the initial invasion of Iraq. And at that time, in a town called An-Nazariya, his unit lost 18 Marines on the bridge, a battle that had was come to be known as Ambush Alley.
Well, in fact, and you thought he was missing for a while. You thought he was killed as well.
Yes, we had two Marines come to our home and let us know that his whereabouts were unknown. Mm-hmm. We knew within 24 hours that he was safe and sound, but he had just become temporarily dislocated from his unit and hooked up with another unit. Mm-hmm. But during that time, they did lose 18 Marines. As a parent, your first initial response is, thank God. Mm-hmm. Then you go through the, and I want to say guilt, because you are thankful that your child is alive, but then there are those other families that you know are grieving.
Yeah, it's a survivor's guilt.
Yes.
Yeah.
And at the time, I really had no clue as to why my son was the fortunate one. It's only afterwards, when this idea presented itself to make these quilts, did I finally come to realize that God saved my son. And he saved him for a reason, and that reason was so that this group could be founded and that we could make sure that every military family knows that America cares.
The families that you are able to give quilts to, can you tell us some of the, you know, the reactions?
We've had one mom who received her quilt on the day that her son's unit returned from Iraq, and she said it was the hardest day of her life. And when the quilt came, she laid it out on the floor, read each one of the squares, reread each one of the squares, then wrapped herself up in it and had the best cry that she's had in the whole time that he's been gone. Mm. We had another wife who posted on the Gold Star Wives website that she said, today is my 7th wedding anniversary. No email, no flowers, no cards, no gift. But the FedEx man came and delivered my Marine comfort quilt. It was a sign from my angel above that, yes, everything was going to be okay.
Your son is home from Iraq. I understand he's going to college.
Yes, my son is put in his 4 years. He's been discharged from the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. And he is now enrolled in college full-time.
And what does he say to you about what you're doing?
He's very proud of it. Early on, when he was still in the military, and he would come home, at first he said nothing about it. There was one point where he called before he came home, and he said, Mom, you really just need to put all that stuff away while I'm home. Hmm. I just can't deal with it.
Hmm. Well, he lost 18 comrades, and that's how this started, so
yes,
it must remind him of that.
Mm-hmm. His second tour in Iraq, he lost another very good friend, a Marine that he had gone through boot camp and School of Infantry with and had been with his whole entire time in the Marine Corps. That was probably the only time that he ever called and made reference to someone in particular. He called from Iraq and said, you're going to need to make a quilt. And I didn't question him. I just let him talk and, you know, had a good friend.
Hmm.
That quilt has been made and delivered.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Jan Lang, founder of MarineComfortQuilts.us, a volunteer group making quilts for every service person killed in Iraq. You say that yours is, you know, it's not the place to comment on the war, but I'm wondering, you have a full-time job while you're doing this with people who also have jobs, and it sounds as if you are working around the clock to try to do this. You are, you know, one of the closest barometers of the death toll in Iraq. You can never ignore it.
When I first started this project, it was very, very hard. Every square that I would get in, every quilt that I would make, I would cry over. It's very, very, very hard when the thank you notes come in, when the pictures come in, and you see the stories and hear the hear about this young man or young woman that this quilt is going to. To talk to the families on the phone. It's very emotional.
You understand you don't even look at the pictures that where you were. You don't even post them. Yeah.
No, it's real hard to look at those pictures, because then you get to the point where you associate. It's very, very hard to explain how you have to keep yourself in check. Otherwise, you would be crying all the time. You know, I'm sitting here right now, and I have tears rolling down my face because this is very, very hard for me.
Jen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Jen Lang is the founder of MarineComfortQuilts.us, a volunteer group that's making quilts for every service person's family, that every service person that's been killed in Iraq. For more information, or if you'd like to help out, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from... And now, as winter approaches, many families are bracing for home heating bills that will be several hundred dollars higher than last year for natural gas and oil. The skyrocketing prices are driving some people to turn back the clock to an old alternative, coal. One result, stores that sell coal and wood stoves here in the Boston area are out of stock until January or even later. Brian Williams is president of Williams Coal and Oil in Braintree, Massachusetts, where the coal business is booming right now, and he joins us to tell us more about it. Brian, hello.
Hi, how are you, Robin?
I'm fine, and I just want to get a picture first, because as you well know, here in the Boston area, up on Beacon Hill and in some old homes, you can still see these coal chutes where coal was delivered from, you know, maybe your grandparents' wagons, right. You know, right into the basements. How does it work now? Is it coal stoves that people are using primarily?
What's happening is that people who have the coal stoves are going back to them. They're taking them out of their barns or garages, and they're hooking them back up, because coal is about half the price of oil and natural gas today. So the savings are so great that people are saying, you know, I'm going to hook up my stove and use coal again.
And what do the stoves look like? Are they just like wood stoves? Or?
Well, they're similar to the wood stoves. They're the regular hand-fired stoves that you may be familiar with, the old potbelly stoves.
Mm-hmm.
There were some local manufacturers that sold a lot of stoves back in the late 70s and early 80s. But recently, there's new stoves that have come out that have automatic feeders, and so you don't have to feed them every day. You just take the ashes out once every 4 or 5 days. And I just took all our employees down to Pennsylvania to see these stoves, mm-hmm. and they're remarkable.
Yeah.
And the manufacturers are out straight trying to keep up with the demand for these.
Right, so those stoves just, you know, it just feeds it like a cat food feeder. It just puts the coal in. But how do you deliver the coal?
Well, we have the old-fashioned coal trucks, believe it or not, with the double hoist. In fact, we just bought 3 new ones this summer because of the demand.
What does that look like?
Well, it's similar to a dump truck, and you're familiar with a dump truck,
mm-hmm.
how it just dumps. But a coal truck body, what happens, it goes up like a dump truck, then it goes up again so it's level, then it goes up again. So
mm-hmm.
it goes up 2 stories, then it dumps. You need the pitch to shoot the coal down the chute, as you say, the homes on Beacon Hill. So you got to get the pits to shoot the coal on the coal trays to where the person keeps his coal bin.
Well, but for people who don't have coal bins down in the basement, we understand that coal is now also delivered in bags.
Yes, yeah, we sell a lot of bags, and they typically come in 40-pound bags, so they're very convenient for people to buy and to store in their garage or whatnot.
And by the way, you mentioned the coal bins in the basement. Before we leave that, back in the day, again about 100 years ago, people burned the coal in the basement, and it heated up big tanks of water, which then traveled through pipes around the house and heated the house. Are you seeing anyone doing that, you know, using coal instead of, let's say, an oil furnace?
Well, yes. I have customers who have coal boilers, coal stokers. The largest number of my customers have coal stoves.
Right. And how many are there? I mean, can you give us a sense of the increase in people using coal stoves?
Well, I have about say 1,000 customers this past year, but I anticipate this year that that number will probably go up about 75% to 100%, because we're getting dozens of calls every day.
Well, now, compare the costs for us. How much cheaper is coal?
It's roughly about 60% of the cost of fuel oil and about 50% of the cost of natural gas.
Wow.
So the savings for the typical home that, say, uses typically around 900 gallons of fuel oil, and you look at today's price of fuel oil, the customer could save between $1,000 and $1,500 by switching to coal.
And how much are the stoves if you don't already have them?
If you buy a brand-new hand-fed stove, you'll probably spend $1,200 to, say, $1,500. If you buy an automatic feeder stove, you could spend in the high teens, $1,700, $1,800, $1,900. Mm. And they come in all different shapes and sizes and colors, so aesthetically they're very pleasing, and they really fit nicely in a lot of homes.
Well, and I'm betting that a homeowner who would do that would say that they'd, you know, they'd pay it off over the years as they save money on oil. Well, but, okay, now we come to the questions about coal, because our memories of coal, it's dirty.
Well, I think this is the distinction you have to make. Years ago, a lot of people used to use bituminous coal, and in coal you have two types. You have bituminous and anthracite. Bituminous is the coal that's primarily used by the power plants, and that's what people associate with coal being dirty and so on. The anthracite coal is nice and clean.
Well, interestingly, you know, we were concerned about, you know, what it would do to the environment, what it would do to the air, that idea of soot, you know. You just picture people covered with soot, you know, when you think of coal. But we read with interest a quote from Seth Kaplan, who's with the Conservation Law Foundation, who said that if, you know, just a few thousand New Englanders, and that's just in this area, of course, were to switch to coal, it doesn't significantly change air quality because it's so few at that point.
Right.
I mean, it's a lot for you,
right,
but it's really not enough to make a dent on the environment, at least according to him. But I'm wondering about the source of coal. You took a trip, as you said, to Pennsylvania. You also visited coal mines, I understand.
Yeah.
You know, we also have this image of, you know, people risking their lives to get coal, and that it is not an unlimited resource.
Well, we have a lot of anthracite coal down in northeastern Pennsylvania. And depending on who you talk to and what you read, they say 200 to 300 years of coal that's still available. And the way it's primarily mined today, it's open pit mining. And basically, you have these large machines that, you know, dig the coal out of the earth. Although on the trip that we just did, they took us to old abandoned underground mines, which was fantastic. So we went in both open pit and underground mines because we took 35 of our employees down to see the mines. And then also we went to coal stove and coal boiler manufacturing companies.
But, Brian, is this field trip in part because of this resurgence? Did you have young people, for instance, on your staff who need to sort of be educated? Okay, this is what coal is.
Well, we have, you know, both men and women who work in our business, and I believe that coal is back. You know, the percentage of the market is very small. It's probably about 0.1%. But given the high energy prices that we have and given the supply of energy that you constantly read about in the paper, that we have limited supplies of oil and gas, something has to be done. And in this country, we have a lot of coal. And, again, we have enough for a couple of hundred years. And it's only 6 hours away from where we are. And so a lot of people who I sell to, they just like the security of knowing that they could buy their energy and store it right down in their coal bin, and they feel very secure. And the price is very stable.
Brian Williams is president of Williams Coal and Oil in Braintree, Massachusetts. His family's owned that business since 1919. He's been talking to us about coal, the new alternative to more expensive oil and natural gas for heating homes this winter. Well, Brian, I know you got to get back to work. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, critics say the use of coal is having an environmental impact on the planet, and 6,000 mine workers were killed in mine accidents in China alone last year. So next week, we're going to take a closer look at the impact of coal use around the world. And coming up, jazzman James Isaacs on new CDs from some of the old giants of jazz. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. American millionaire scientist Gregory Olson is back on planet Earth after 7 days in space orbit with a joint Russian-American crew. Olson is only the third ever space tourist. He booked his trip through an American company, a sort of space travel agency called Space Adventures. They're based in Arlington, Virginia. Olson blasted off from the Baikonur launch facility in Kazakhstan on October 1st, docked to the International Space Station 2 days later, and landed back on Earth on the steps of Kazakhstan on October 10th. For this, he paid $20 million. Gregory Olson, was it worth it?
It sure was. It was an event of my lifetime after the birth of my daughters and grandchildren. I'm happy I did it, and I'm looking forward to sharing the experience with many others, including young children.
Were you ever frightened?
Never. I had a great vehicle and a great crew. My only concern going up was maybe something would happen where I wouldn't go. And once that rocket started taking off, I just felt euphoria all over.
What I was going to ask, what else did it feel like?
You know, I felt the G-forces going up. When I tried to lift my hand, it felt like I had a 10-pound weight attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about 8 minutes of that, all of a sudden my hand was sort of floating off my knees. Mm-hmm. And I knew then we were in orbit.
What did you see in your trip?
Well, initially, you know, there's a protective covering going through the atmosphere, so I couldn't see anything going up except the inside of the vehicle. But at about, 40, 50 miles high, the nose fairing was blasted off, and all of a sudden I saw this blue earth before me. You know, it was kind of receding, and it was just a great feeling to know that we were on our way.
How much did you have to train for this?
I trained for a total of about 8 months. I put in 900 hours. I was trained in all aspects of the vehicle. I'm not qualified to operate the Soyuz vehicle, but I'm certainly qualified to fly in it. A lot of physical training and a lot of exams.
To learn what? To learn how you might feel?
That too. We did zero-G flights. We did centrifuge to see how my body would behave, you know, under those conditions. Fortunately, I did very well in all of that. But there were many classes on, you know, how to operate the radio system, the safety features, the oxygen, purification, fire, what to do in emergency situations, what if there's a depressurization. Have to be trained in all of this so that if an event occurs, you can respond quickly.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of controversy over this idea of tourism in space. Some say it's unsafe, that tourists can get in the way. You know, what's that button for? And some say, you know, it only allows the rich elite a chance to travel in space, that it starts to drive a divide. Your thoughts on that?
That's true in the beginning, just like it was for ocean travel and early airline travel. But I like to think that what Dennis Tito, Mark Shuttleworth, and I did will lead to many others doing it, and ultimately it's going to bring the price down. For instance, if the demand for this increases, you'll start having multi-passenger vehicles, and, you know, that will drop the flight down.
Burger yeah, to 10 million.
Well, you know, it'll go down a lot more than that. To me, what it's doing, it's getting the public to participate in space.
Yeah. And why is that important?
Because, look, space is our frontier. You know, you used the word earlier, elite. While I recognize it was a real privilege for me to do this, I believe eventually everybody should have at least the opportunity to do this.
And you said you want to talk to kids about it, and that's part of your goal. But some might say, gee, Greg Olson, $20 million could have been spent on, you know, refurbishing hundreds of American schools.
Yeah, that's true. And I thought about that for a long time before I made the decision to go. I will point out that, you know, we have a family foundation, and we've given away more money to good causes that are close to us than we've spent on space. But, you know, after careful consideration, I thought that by having this experience and sharing it with many, many people, hopefully motivating young people, especially from inner cities, that, you know, I came from a modest background, and, you know, if I share my story with them, maybe they'll say, hey, this is something I could do, too.
And by the way, Greg Olson, what do you do?
All right. Well, my background is I'm a scientist and entrepreneur. You know, my company, Sensors Unlimited, makes infrared cameras that I use for night vision to examine artwork and many process control features.
Well, and just that alone might get kids heading to their science classes thinking,
yes,
did pretty
yes
good with science.
Yep.
Dr. Gregory Olson just spent $20 million to become the third civilian to travel in space. He just recently returned from his trip. Dr. Olson, thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Here and Now. They're being called the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Rosetta Stone of bebop. Two new recordings by four jazz masters have only recently been discovered and released on CD. James Isaacs, Here and Now jazz aficionado, joins us now to sing the praises of these treasures of jazz. James, welcome as always.
Hi, Robin.
So, who are the giants we speak of?
Well, nobody special. Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Thelonious Monk, and John Coltrane.
Okay, only four of the most significant musicians of the past 60 years. So,
you could say that.
Where do you want to begin?
Well, let's start in 1945, although, Robin, we just heard a snippet of Monk and Coltrane from 1957, and we'll be getting back to that presently.
Okay.
But yeah, we'll start in 1945, when the alto saxophonist and composer Charlie Parker and the trumpeter-composer Dizzy Gillespie were, I guess you could call them the twin heartbeats of a new music called bebop. June 22nd, 1945 was the date. Town Hall in New York City was the place, and Bird and Diz and their quintet were part of a concert at Town Hall. As it turns out, this incredible music was recorded on 7 12-inch acetate discs, but then the discs were lost until a medical doctor from upstate New York, a guy named Robert Sonnenblick, found one of these acetate discs. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
In an Elks Lodge in Chelmsford, Massachusetts.
You kid.
No.
What was it doing there?
I fun you not. Well, there was a record collector's show or convention or something at this Elks Hall in Chelmsford, Mass., and Dr. Sonnenblick attends these get-togethers on a regular basis. Once he found that first disc, Dr. Sonnenblick got on the jazz collector's grapevine, and eventually he talked to a guy who'd found the other six acetates at an antique store near Stamford, Connecticut. This tale gets more and more convoluted.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
So, a deal was struck, and this past summer, Dr. Sonnenblick's Uptown label released Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Town Hall, New York City, June 22nd, 1945. That is the title.
Well, so, big deal in jazz. What separates this music from the studio music that we know of?
Well, first of all, the sound is superior to just about anything Parker and Gillespie recorded in the studio or live in the 1940s and 50s. But more important, we get to hear them stretch out on numbers that run roughly twice as long as the Studio 78 recordings of the time.
What should we hear from this terrific concert at Town Hall?
Well, Robin, what I thought we'd do is listen to two segments from the same tune, the bebop anthem A Night in Tunisia, which was written by Dizzy Gillespie. First, we're going to hear a trumpet passage. Dizzy was a master of the trumpet's upper register and was noted as well for his double-time phrases. And both aspects come shining through here.
Night in Tunisia from A Wonderful Night at Town Hall in New York.
This is a fantastic document, wonderful music throughout. And now the second part of A Night in Tunisia, the Charlie Parker segment of the program. What unbelievable technique, what drive, what daring, what astonishing musicianship. Just four bars, Charlie Parker at the peak of his powers in 1945.
James, I'll pick you up off the floor, because that was so good, knocked you down.
Yeah, I think you're going to have to give me some help here.
And let's continue. What's next?
What's next? Another live concert in New York as we move forward a dozen years to November 29th, 1957, when the quartet of the singular pianist-composer Thelonious Sphere Monk, featuring a still-developing John Coltrane on tenor saxophone. This band was part of a Carnegie Hall bill. Are you ready for this lineup?
Mm-hmm.
Billie Holiday, Dizzy Gillespie and his orchestra, Chet Baker with Zoot Sims, Sonny Rollins, and, as a special added attraction, Ray Charles. Oh, and the top ticket price was $3.95, including tax.
People got their money's worth. But
really?
So how did these newly discovered recordings come to light?
Fairly straightforward story here, Robin. This concert, which was a benefit, was recorded for radio broadcast on Voice of America, but subsequently the tapes were somehow mislabeled. In any event, in January of this year, an archivist at the Library of Congress in Washington happened upon the unlabeled canisters, et voila, 8 months later, Thelonious Monk Quartet with John Coltrane at Carnegie Hall was released to great fanfare on Blue Note Records.
Well, let's get an idea of how rare this is. They didn't work together very long, only about 6 months. They'd only recorded three studio performances. And
that's it.
These weren't, you know, these were songs.
Yeah, that's it. Then in 1993, Blue Note released a CD of a tape that was recorded live at the Five Spot in 1957 by John Coltrane's first wife. However, she used a portable tape recorder with a single microphone. So while the music was invaluable, the sound quality was, shall we say, lacking. That is definitely not the case on this new collection. 51 minutes of prime Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane sounds great all the way.
Very special. And I know that Coltrane played with Miles Davis before he joined Thelonious Monk.
He did.
Why did he leave Miles?
Miles fired him.
Well,
Coltrane had a serious drug and alcohol problems at the time. He went home to Philadelphia, cleaned up, went with Thelonious Monk, and the brief time they worked together proved to be a pivotal period in Coltrane's creative life.
How so?
What I'm going to do is read you a brief quote that Coltrane gave Downbeat magazine in 1960. Coltrane said, "I would talk to Monk about musical problems, and he would sit at the piano and show me the answers by playing them. I could watch him play and find out things I wanted to know. Also, I could see a lot of things I didn't know at all."
And now we can hear
that in
action. What shall we listen to from this new Monk and Coltrane at Carnegie Hall?
One of Monk's most familiar compositions. This is a blues called Blue Monk. And on the surface, rather straightforward tune, but the way in which Coltrane harmonizes the theme statement with Monk's piano is hardly commonplace. But that's the kind of thing that Monk inspired in Coltrane. Go in a new direction, try new ideas. So we're going to hear a bit of Coltrane solo after the theme with Monk's jagged chords spurring him on. And the sense of discovery behind the notes is just tremendously exciting. He's in the most challenging musical situation of his life, and he comes through with flying colors.
From the new release, Monk and Coltrane at Carnegie Hall. Here now, jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Thanks, as always, for letting us listen to the Giants for a while.
My pleasure, Robin. Giants indeed. Giants walked the earth in those days.
And you can find out more about these new CDs, including reviews, on our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.